Done one right. And Rick and Debbie and Jane report this Wednesday after supper, the 13th of December, 72. Rick and Jane and Debbie report this Wednesday after supper, the 13th of December, 72. Channel 1 right, in the beginning of the visit of Jane and Debbie and Rick report this Wednesday, the 13th of December, 72. Channel 1 right, beginning of Rick and Debbie and Jane's report this Wednesday after supper, the 13th of December, 72.
You know, that's usually what your mother does.
Mm-hmm.
I assume your mother is somebody.
No, I'm going to brag consultant.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, somebody else does.
A real profession, you know.
Tony is not one to, you know, organize things like that. It's just not his.
Yeah, that was something. And then Bob.
But, you know, I didn't get that too clear in my mind, right? Now, your part of it, well, what did you have to do with getting them up here? It wasn't your idea, was it?
My idea.
What?
Well, Tony, Russell and Bob were supposed to come up. See, Russell, Bob, Tony, and David we're all just real good friends. We have been since high school. And Russell wasn't an usher, but the rest of us were. But we just kind of included Russell in on it. David flew in from Massachusetts to Miami and then over to Tampa. So that put three of them in Tampa, and none of them had a car.
Oh.
Or none of them had a car that would make it this far. So I got a call, said, "You going to come pick us up?" I said, "Well, Russell's got a car." "Yeah, you know about Russell's car?" And I went, "Oh, you need a ride." "That's right." I said, "Pick us up Friday noon." I said, "Okay." Well, I went over and had Thanksgiving dinner Thursday with Tony and Linda. And we were all sitting around fat and kind of sleepy, and I couldn't think of anything to do. And I said, "Well, why don't we just drive over tonight and get them, just surprise them?" It's a terrible idea.
You had it?
Yes. I just thought that would be a lot of fun, just breaking on the spur of the moment.
You mean you go around having ideas?
Sometimes. And we discussed and thought that's terrible because Linda had a lot to do that night, a lot to do early tomorrow morning.
Yeah.
And I said, "Yeah, it would be inconvenient, but wouldn't it be a lot of fun? And why, I could wash the dishes, and Tony could straighten up, and you could get cleaned up, and we could just run over. We could be back by 12 o'clock, or we could leave tomorrow morning early." And they said, "All right." And it was really worth it then. Oh, Linda just lit up, and she ran and took a shower and got packed, and Tony ran all the apartment, straightened everything up, and I washed the dishes. Oh, we just got the biggest kick out of that. It was just so great to see everybody just come alive because we had something to do.
Thursday night.
Mm-hmm. And we took off about 8:30 and got in at 10:30. Yep. Three of us crept up to Bob's door. We started singing, "We're here because we're here because we're here." Bob reaches over and pulls down the shade. And locks the door and lets us in. He goes, "You're supposed to be here tomorrow." I said, "I know, Bob. We just thought we'd come tonight." Tony sat down in a chair, and there was this empty glass there, and he raised his arm and knocked it off, and it fell over. And there was this wine right there with about six bottles of wine. It hadn't supposed to have six. It had five. And Bob goes, "Oh, no." Tony says, "Well, it's okay. It didn't smell anything. It was empty." And then Bob started laughing. And he looked over at David, and David says, "Tell him, tell him." So Bob says, Tony, that's your wedding present, and Reynolds, if you had come tomorrow, would have had it wrapped. And then Bob pulled me aside and said, not only that, we drank one of the bottles of wine. So I'm sorry. Is he ready to go? He says, I haven't done my laundry. I said, well, bring it on. We'll wash it in Gainesville. So we haul off Bob and the wine rack and all the bottles of wine.
And the laundry.
All the clothes he owned. In his big old bag. He didn't even have any clean clothes to wear. Didn't have any money. And I said, well, bring your checkbook and I'll just go your check when we get to Gainesville. So we hauled him off. He said, do you know what you're going to do to Russell? He says, yeah, we're going to pick him up. He says, I don't know. I said, well, we'll just surprise him. So we did the same thing. We all got out and sang. And Russell just opened the door and looked at us. Didn't say a word. He looked at Bob, shook his head, and Bob goes, yeah, I know. Russell's girlfriend is there, and she didn't want Russell to go off that weekend. She was mad. Oh, was she mad? She just went to the other room and wouldn't talk to anybody. I went, uh-oh. So Russell went and packed a few clothes and came on out with us. Didn't say much of anything the whole trip back. He just wrote BB on the back window because it was all fogged up. Well, see, BB stands for Buffalo Bob because we used to call Bob Buffalo Bob. He just hates it. And we had a little theme song. That saying, Buffalo Bob, won't you come out tonight? Come out tonight. Come out tonight. Buffalo Bob, won't you come out tonight by the light of the silvery moon? And we just sing that in chorus after chorus all the way back. And Bob would sit there. And then they'd poke him. Hey, Bob, you got any hair on your chest? Well, Bob is blonde, see? His blonde mustache. He didn't have any hair on his chest. And Tony's Cuban has got this ferocious hairy chest. And he's always... And Bob says, that's okay. I'm Apollo. I'm Apollo. That's okay. Oh, man. So we got... town, once we got going the next day, I found out Bob didn't have any money with him. Russell hadn't cashed his paycheck, so I had to go to the bank and cover all their checks. The bank accepted them, but then they put a hold on my account. And I'd already shot a big part of my account, you know, renting tuxedos, and then I had to pay for David's tuxedo because he didn't have any money enough to pay for the tuxedo. Then there were wedding presents, and Russell says, you know, I haven't bought a wedding present either. Oh, no. So we took them all over to have breakfast, and poor Linda had to cook, and I had to borrow a frying pan from the house in town and take it over there so she could cook eggs and bacon at the same time. I thought, that poor girl, she's got all this wedding to set up and five hungry guys to cook for too. And I had to haul off Russell and Bob. We left Bob washing clothes and took Russell over to go shopping. See, Russell doesn't like to mess around with them. He just walks in the store and looks around, sees this wooden bowl set, says, that's nice, I'll buy that. I spend 2 or 3 days shopping. Well, I'll get that.
That's fair.
See, I don't recognize the boy at all.
That's somebody else.
It isn't Rick that I know at all.
Yeah, no, you've not met this one. Now that was up here that you started shopping.
Yeah.
That morning of the wedding?
Yeah, I figured if I put it off to the last day, I'd have to buy something. I'd have to make up my mind. I couldn't make up my mind what to buy until then. And then when I got desperate, I just didn't argue. I just, the first thing I liked, I bought that. So I got him some Corningware. And Russell bought the bowls. And we took them back to Bradley's apartment, which is this part that was loaned to us. And we got in all this ribbon and this paper. I'd got it. Russell tried to pick it out, but he's colorblind, and he was getting orange and blue and things like that. And I said, no, Russell. Yeah, it looks nice. I said, Russell, you can't tell. I said, oh, that's right. So I took it back, and I can't wrap packages real well. I always get balled up. I didn't have any scissors. So David says, oh, I can wrap them really good. I said, do it. So he starts wrapping away, and all of a sudden, here, this rip, tear, rip. And I looked over. And he was just mashing it down, see? And when a piece didn't fit, he'd just rip it off. What are you doing? A door. And then he tucks it all in and puts tape on it. And it looked fine. And I looked over, and Russell had this beautiful wrapping. He knew how to wrap, and he never told me. You know, I'd let David just rip all that beautiful paper to pieces. Well, we got those tuxedos. We got them that afternoon. Well, we put them on, the four of us over there. They all pretty much dress like I do, you know, these old stained jeans and faded shirts and stuff. And they hadn't shaved in a couple days, so we're just waiting for the day of the wedding to start, you know, preening a little bit. They all went and took a shower and shaved and brushed their teeth and combed their hair. And they put on these tuxedos with ruffled shirts. They looked like a convention of penguins. And Tony went, combed his hair back, and I'm a pianist. Oh, Chopin, come in. And David, who's Guatemalan, has kind of a German extraction too, because I think his father's, he combed his hair back walking, well, what we have today in the physics lecture? No. And I was all dressed up, I had my hair parted in the middle, you know. So we were parading around like that. And Tony was real, it was kind of touching. All of a sudden he just started crying and went up and hugged everybody. It's like kind of goodbye. I'm just breaking the ice. I won't tell you which one's going to be next, but I'm just breaking the ice. But no, Tony, no. So, see, I was just driving the whole weekend because nobody had any transportation or a car big enough. Tony had a car, but it would only seat four. And it's hard to get in and out of. And I've got a four-door. And after about the 20th trip, Bob gets out of the back and says, you know, Rick, I'm really glad you got four doors in your car. So you see, I took Jane over the wedding and left her, and then had to make sure that Bob got there, and Tony and David. And then the rest of the wedding party didn't show up, so I had to get an umbrella out and go find them, and I just bought the umbrella that day. Doggone if it didn't open it, and accidentally one of the little tines was hooked in it. Bennett, a brand new umbrella, paid $4 for the damn thing. And found out later I could have gotten it for $1.50 somewhere else. So I just, brand new umbrella, bent on one side, and running around in the rain in this suit with these patent leather shoes, trying to keep everything clean. And finally everybody comes up. And after the wedding, during the ceremony, I just hardly saw anything.
But you had you managed. When did you arrange for the ceremony?
That afternoon, about 2 hours before the wedding.
They on the campus?
You mean practice the ceremony?
No. I mean, when did you get the preacher?
Oh, they'd done that way ahead.
Oh, had they?
Catholics have to go through a whole counseling session. They have to buy these little books. And I had to go down and witness that I'd known Tony for so long and that he hadn't been married before and sign these papers. And then he had to go through all these conferences with the preacher, or the priest. And he didn't like it. See?
Well, that'd been going on.
Oh, yes. And it'd been heated, too. This is the first wedding the priest had ever done. And Tony goes in, and he said, do you go to church, right? And I said, no. Do you go to confession? No. And he goes, oh. Tony says, but I'm a good man. And the priest says, you're a good man. By what right are you a good man? And Tony was telling me this. He said, now if I'd said I was good by the word of God or by the Bible, see, he would have got me. So I just said, I'm good in consideration of man's past. And the priest said, you're an arrogant SOB. Oh, no.
Don't tell me.
Well, we got in there Saturday afternoon. They made arrangements for the reception and for the wedding, but, you know, you have to set up your the way everybody's going to go down the aisle. So the priest got up there and he said, I'm just going to go through what I'll say at the ceremony, you know, just the wedding part. Now, the processional and the recessional, you all can just work it out yourself. Which sounds like a real nice thing to say, except that nobody knew. And it would have been nice to have a little advice from him. Only he didn't know either. So he ran through the words a few times, and the florist was up there the whole time, Where do I put this? Where's the altar going to be? You want the candles over here? Who's going to roll down the rug? And I'm trying to talk to the florist and keep her quiet because she had to go back. And then the priest left, and I had to go send Tony after the priest to bring him back to find out where the altar would be. So I got the florist to leave us a strip of tape because they have this white rug. Well, it's like a... It's thin, you know, like a sheet. But you roll that all the way down, and the bride walks up it. And you have to tape it where it goes down the steps. So I hung that tape in the back room. And Bob was supposed to go early and tape down the rug. Because I had to go pick up people, see. And he was going to be at the church before I was. Well, I forgot to tell him where the tape was. And when I got there, and we're ushering people in, sitting down, he says, oh, by the way, you know, the damn florist didn't leave us any tape. I'm like, uh-oh. Yes, you did, Bob. So I had to run in the back room and get this tape. And, of course, everybody's sat down, and the candles are lit, and people are waiting. And I'm up there taping down this carpet, you know, smiling and blushing and starting to sweat and nervous. Trying to be discreet, you know, running around in this beautiful tuxedo with a big strip of tape in my hand. Well, we set up that processional. I was the only one who'd been to a wedding. Tony had never been to a wedding. Linda had never been to the wedding. The parents only remembered theirs, and they didn't offer any suggestions. And Tony was nervous, and he said, well, we'll worry about that later. And Linda's father looks over and says, I think the time to worry about it is now. Oh, yeah, yeah. So we worked out something, and then the organist came down. And she's been to weddings all the time. She's seen all kinds. And she said, oh, you're going to do it that way? And I said, oh, damn it. Here we've worked it all out. You had to go say that. I said, well, you've been to a lot of weddings, haven't you? And I thought, well, I'll just use the method arm. Well, yes, I've been to a lot of weddings. See, they usually stand here, here, and here and do this, this, and this. And I go, oh. We talked it over. Decided it wouldn't work because we didn't have enough people. So we went ahead and had it where the ushers went up first. And stood on the upper level, and then Tony and Linda came up. And we walked through it and got it set up. And then we took Russell, who wasn't an usher, and put him up at the choir loft, see, up there with the organist. And what he was supposed to do is when he saw Linda start, give the organist the cue for the music. Now, Russell's got this big mustache thing. And the whole time we're ushering people down to sit down, I'd look up and he'd go, hi. And laugh. And of course, you're having to keep a solemn face, you know, and take all these people down and chat with them. And he's out there. So, well, that ceremony, just like that, everything worked. We sat the mothers. And Bob and I hooked up the carpet and rolled it all the way back. And as it unrolled, lo and behold, the florist had put tapes on the end, so when it hit the ground, it stuck. I thought, that's a nice sign or something. And then we walked on up, stood there at the altar, and Linda came down with her father, and Tony was waiting, and they joined hands and went up. And the priest looked at him and said, would you like to kneel? And they were both kind of wobbling. So down they went. You kept hearing that the whole time. And the priest would say a few words, and you hear Pepe go. Pepe was Tony's brother. He was just as drunk as he could be.
On the front seat?
Mm-hmm. He was about two rows back. And the priest would just look up like, oh, you know, like, and he'd smile like that was supposed to happen. And he'd look down at Tony, and he'd look at me, and kind of shrug and go on and talking. And then he says, everyone rise. And they went through some prayers, and then he said, you may be seated or kneel or whatever.
Unbelievable.
I thought, whatever? And Bob looks over at me and kind of crosses his eyes and makes a funny face. Oh, the ceremony just came right off. Except Tony was supposed to say to Linda, I promise my love and fidelity. And in the apartment, while he was getting dressed, he'd been practicing it, saying, I promise my love and sympathy. Wait, no, Tony. Oh, I promise my love and devotion. No, Tony, it's love and fidelity. He said, that's right, love and fidelity, love and fidelity. He got up to the altar. Linda says, I promise my love and fidelity. And Tony says, I promise my love and devotion. And I told him later, he says, is that what I said? I said, yeah. Oh, I don't remember anything. I don't even know what I said. And I said, well, you heard him, Linda. Uh-uh, I didn't hear him. The priest even had to remind him to kiss her after they were married. You may kiss her now. And then halfway down, he lifts the veil and kisses her, and then he pulls the veil back down. And he gets down, and when they get by Linda's father, he says, the veil can go up. Oh, and he puts the veil back up. So they loaded up my car, Tony and Linda, and David, the best man, and drove over to the reception. And Bob, the usher, and myself, and Jane, and Russell got in Tony's car, the little Cougar. And Bob pulled out this $20 bill. And he said, Peppy gave me this. He wants a good bottle of scotch over there. Well, Peppy had already gone through a bottle of Johnny Walker scotch, a whole fifth, or a quart. And he was loaded. He drinks a great deal. As a matter of fact, he's an alcoholic. So I guess he could handle that much scotch without passing out yet. He applauded a good bit in the ceremony. Whenever David lit the candles, he applauded the whole time. So but I said, all right. So we went over to ABC Liquor. And the whole time, Russell was up in the front seat with his bag of goodies we bought. We bought ribbon and crepe paper streamers and this American flag and a bunch of balloons. See, we were going to decorate the car. So we had about 130 balloons. And I like balloons. I just get a big kick out of balloons. And everybody else doesn't like balloons. Jane says, I don't like balloons. Bob says, I can't blow them up. I said, what'd you buy the balloons for? I said, well, we're going to blow them up and fill up the car so they can't get in. And they said, we are? I said, well, yeah. So Bob took one and tried to blow it up. And he goes, I can't do it. And he looks at it and he puts it in his mouth and starts chewing on it. He says, I can't blow them up, but they're great to chew on. So he drove and chewed on the balloon, and I started blowing off. Well, I blow up balloons good. I can really blow up a balloon. And I've got it up, and I'll tie it in no time. Russell could blow them up, but he couldn't tie them well. And he'd get it tied, and then it would deflate, and then he couldn't get the knot out, see. I guess I blew up 75% of those balloons. And Jane was over beside me working away, and we were kind of in competition there. She was doing awful good. Bob went in and got the bottle of liquor, and we went on back over the reception. And of course, half the people were in, so we had to form this impromptu receiving line. And the people were already drinking. Oh, and they run back and go back through the receiving line. So Bob and I were, hello, introducing ourselves. And I turned to Bob and said, would you like to use my name for a while? He said, okay. So he, when someone came through, he said, hello, I'm Rick Reynolds. When they got to me, I said, hello, I'm Bob Scheibel. Got a big kick out of that. And they had this tray all set up with these fine champagne glasses. And this elderly black man would come in his white clothes, you know, kind of a waiter's serving jacket, and this fine bottle of champagne. They bought about 7 bottles of real good champagne. And he had this white towel wrapped around it, and he carried it, you know, upright, holding the towel, and he'd pour all these glasses. Then we'd leave and go back to the kitchen, and everybody take a glass of champagne. And every so often, he'd come back and pour, only he didn't come back very often. And I figured they must have poured about 4 bottles of champagne, and we never saw the other 3. And they'd order 12 dozen of these little finger sandwiches. I know we didn't go through that many. We got the wedding cake back. They didn't eat all that. Linda brought it back and set it up on the bookshelf of her apartment for about a week, and then offered me a piece, and I said, well, I don't think so.
Mm-hmm. Oh, afterwards, they just came on back and went through after the honeymoon.
Tony?
Uh-huh.
Yeah, they were only out of town 2 days.
Just settled down.
Yeah, for a little bit.
But it was wet on the way to the down for the reception.
It rained that day, It started Friday night about midnight, and it rained all the way through Sunday.
Mm-hmm.
And the only time it stopped raining was about 7:30, and that was just when Linda had to walk outside from the library over to the chapel. And we were thinking we would get a bunch of laundry bags or something and make a great big plastic bag to put her in that she could go across if it was raining like that. But it stopped long enough, so it didn't damage her dress. But it rained from then on. And see, when we were at the reception, I stayed there with Jane, and all the other ushers start slipping out, see, going down to decorate the car. In fact, we didn't tell where the car was. That was one of the good things about not having Tony and Linda drive their own car from the church to the reception. They didn't know where it was. They were afraid we'd go through the luggage and maybe alter the engine a little bit. But I promised, made a solemn promise that the car would run. I didn't say how well it would run. I just said it would run when they got it. So we just left it decorated, filling it with balloons and putting streamers on. Of course, it rained the whole time, and all the colors ran. And I had bought these rolls of ribbon, about a dozen of these little rolls of ribbon. And they're good for maybe at Christmas. They're good. They'll wrap about one package. Bob opened it.
Well, Rich, you must have had some little investment in all that.
About $100. That's what it cost me that whole weekend.
If I were going to get married again, I would like for Rick to direct my wedding.
You should hire out Rick. He could be a wedding consultant.
A fool, that's what I am. Bob got those little streamers, and he goes, flips them, and he says, hey, these are great. And he wouldn't give them to anybody. He flipped them all out and tied them on the back of the car. And I got Tony and Linda. She said, my foot's hurting. See, she'd broken her toe about 4 months ago. She kicked Tony. Broke her toe. And had worn shoes before the wedding and hurt her foot so much that she almost had to go to the hospital. The pain got so bad one night.
Oh, yes, you can do that. I came cab down there and broke my ankle. Couldn't walk for 2 weeks.
I kicked
my boot off. So I just kicked plain.
I had to take her a big pan. There was this big pan at the house in town, so I took that over to her, and we got some Epsom salts. I filled it up with warm water and told her to go soak her foot before the wedding. And we figured she could make it for about half an hour with a shoe on before it started really hurting.
Oh, yeah. So that's when she had to slip out.
Right, and then I drove him over. Yes. I said, where's the car? I said, oh, we'll bring it around when you get back. It's way off, and you don't want to walk through all that rainy weather. Well, it was right by the union. It wasn't any further than mine. But they didn't know that. And I drove them over there, and I said, well, you're just going to change, and I'll take you back for the rest of the reception. Oh, we're not going back to that reception. We have had enough. We're leaving. We're going on our honeymoon. And I said, oh. Well, I'll take you back to get the car, right? Right. I know, that's good. Linda pulled off the guard and says, here, you deserve this. Thanks, Linda. Just what I need. And they all get back in the car, and Tony looks at me and says, I got one more favor to ask you, Rick. I said, anything, Tony. He said, have you got a Florida map? He said, wait, tell you what, Tony. I'll just drive you over there, wherever you want to go. He said, no. Just give me the map, Rick. So I gave him my map and drove him back over to the union. But there'd been a lot going on in between that I didn't know about. There'd been a lot going on in the reception that I hadn't seen.
Well, that's what Zane was telling us about.
Yeah. See, it seemed all gone on in between.
You were in the church while Rick was running errands. And you saw this sister-in-law dressed in black.
From head to toe.
Black boots?
They have black boots to her knees and a black midi skirt and a long sleeve black sweater with a turtleneck. And bleached blonde hair. She only bit of color on her.
I don't know. Well, how do you account for that?
I don't know. never smiled the whole time she was there. I didn't see her smile once.
That'd be rather conspicuous, wouldn't it?
Yeah.
You couldn't hardly make yourself inconspicuous. Was that?
Mm-mm. The little kid had on red, bright red dress, bright red suit or something. The baby did.
And you didn't know whether she's working walking the baby or the baby walking her, huh?
No, she I guess she was just nervous about her brother-in-law, so she was pacing for him. But the baby was good; it never opened its mouth, never one time did it cry. And she finally did sit down when the service started, right about the time the wedding music started. She finally did perch on the end of the pew that I was sitting in, about the last 2 inches of it.
Oh.
And she perched, and the minute they started out, she was up marching around again back and forth. And even when we stood up, we had to stand up for a while during the service, she just sort of marched back and forth. Right at the end of the pew there.
Well, what was she, just nervous?
I guess she was just nervous, and she had this trouble with her husband. And she was up there, you know, without him. And it wasn't her family that was getting married, it was her husband's family, so I guess just that all made her nervous. And then all the confusion, too.
She's just about an outsider, wasn't she? Oh, she did it for the child's sake. But his child.
Yeah, I was too young to really know what was going on. But she did go. I think she just felt that one of the two of them should be there at Tony's wedding, and I guess the husband just wouldn't go.
Is that the way it was?
I guess so. I
that was that was the impression I got, because somebody, one of the people who was there asked her if she was Tony's sister, and she said no, I'm Tony's sister-in-law. My husband and I are separated. But I thought she said I thought one of us should be at the wedding.
That's right. That's what I heard. Yeah, he wouldn't come.
Yeah.
But she didn't take part in anything.
Mm-mm. She finally, at the reception, I noticed she did sit down for a minute, and she had a glass of champagne. But even for most of the reception, she just around in circles.
With a child.
Yeah.
And the child was smiling.
It was just a happy, cute little kid, never cried. And she talked to it. She'd talk to it and coo to it and sort of whistle to it and make little noises to it. She did all this, though, with this really fast pace, marching around with a frown on her face. But she talked to the kid, and it never did cry.
Yeah.
Now, I have never seen a child be quiet so long in a church. You know, it seems like the minute you get one in trial, it'll let out a scream. But that one never opened its mouth.
And the parents were at loose ends.
Mm-hmm. Because they couldn't speak English.
Yeah.
And they were all alone in the big city. They didn't know what was going on or what was expected of them or what should they do or where should they go or where should they be.
Yeah.
And they have the one of their children was over crying, another one was over passing out, and one had just gotten married, so it was a pretty hard day for them as far as their kids go.
Yeah.
And they just didn't know what was going on, and we would try to explain it, or David, the best man, would try to explain, but he didn't know enough Spanish, really. And they had four or five helpful people around who couldn't help them. You know. And the poor mother, she didn't know what to do. She had somehow, I don't know just how she got it, but somehow or other she managed to get handed two or three of the wedding presents that belonged to Linda. And she's carting them around. And they were heavy. And she's just a little teeny tiny thing. She didn't come to my shoulder. And she has this big, beautiful corsage, these pretty pale yellow roses, pretty corsage. She's carrying around these boxes, mashing the flowers. And I said to her, well, I'll hold the boxes for you. And I held them out, and I was going to take them from her, and so she'd let me hold them for a while. And then when Linda came back with Tony, I handed them to Linda, and she grabbed them away from me, and she said, no, we're going to take them to Linda's house. She told me that, and her daughter told me in English. She told me in Spanish. And so she marched off, mashing her flowers, carrying these boxes.
I wish she was back in Miami.
I'm sure.
Yeah.
But.
Well, the Tony's crowd took it in stride. Is the older people that a little hard on them?
I think it was hard on everybody. I missed all the trouble there at the reception when Pepe was real drunk. And I was just kind of, just didn't mind. I thought that just went along with weddings. But all the, Bob was all worn out and David was all worn out. Of course, David was the one that had to sustain everything because he spoke both languages.
Yeah. Oh.
See?
Oh.
He had to just about run the whole reception. In fact, David proposed a toast, and he was real nice about it.
Yeah.
He gave it in English, and then he said, and for those who speak Spanish, and then he gave it in Spanish.
Oh, yeah.
And I thought that was really nice.
If you just hold on faith, something will happen. It'll come through. Look, Ray. Do you remember that thing? I just wondered, Debbie. There's no resemblance in that session that you had looking for a job with that Mr. Slobowski. Do you see any relation?
Well, I don't know, Mr. Well, Mr. Fleischman tried to speak French to me. That was fun.
Yeah.
His name was Ivan Fleischman. Ivan, sort of.
Well, how'd you get
Russian.
Into the Mr. Ivan?
Well, see, I wasn't very clever about looking for jobs this time because the first time I'd gone up to Boston to look for jobs, it had been so easy. I had gotten a job right away. I hadn't even had to work at it. They just sort of dropped in my lap because it was real easy to get jobs then.
Yeah.
Well, this time
that
it was
2 years ago.
Yeah, it was in 1969, 3 years ago. Long time ago. And it was just real easy to get jobs then. There are a lot of them around. Well, this fall, there just weren't too many around, and I didn't try real hard. And so I looked in the papers mostly. You know, I'd look in the Boston Globe. Well, lo and behold, one Sunday, I looked in the Boston Globe, and it was this big ad about this big. Somebody at Norwood Hospital needed a public relations secretary. And I thought, well, that's right up my alley. That's just what I did. I'll just answer this ad. So I called up and I said I'd like to make an appointment to come and talk to you about this job. And she said, well, we can't see you today, but we can see you tomorrow morning at 10. And I said, well, could you tell me how to get to Norwood? Norwood is outside of Boston. And she said, you don't have a car? And I said, well, no, I was going to take public transportation. She said, well, I'm sorry, I can't tell you how to get here. You'll have to find out yourself. And I said, well, can you tell me where the hospital is in the town so I can find it when I get to the hospital, when I get to the town? And she said, yeah, it's right on the main road. You can't miss it. That helps a lot, doesn't it? It's right on the main road. You can't miss it. So I called the MTA information, and they didn't tell me a thing. And then I called the train station, and there was a commuter train that went out there at like 8 o'clock in the morning, went out to Norwood. So I figured, well, I had to take that. There was no other way to get there. So I took a commuter train. I was the only person on the train going out of South Station. And I got there about an hour and a half before my interview.
Well, you were going out, and the commuters that time, they were coming in.
That's right. That's right. I was going
that's
out.
That's the way to ride, isn't it?
Well, there was no one on the train but me and the conductor. So,
Didn't last long, though, did it?
Oh, it lasted about 25 minutes.
Yeah.
Yeah, from downtown. But see, the trouble was, I was already out in Newton, and it took me 20 minutes to get into Boston to take the train back out again 20 minutes.
Oh.
Which was kind of backtracking a little bit. But
oh, yeah.
Anyway, I arrived in Norwood, and I asked the man in the train station, I was the only person in the train station, too, and I asked the man in the train station if he could tell me where the hospital was. So all I knew was it was on the main street. And he said, well, it's just right up the road. And it was. I was quite lucky. It was just at the end of the road.
You walked.
I walked. Mm-hmm. But I was an hour and a half before my interview. So I thought, well, I don't want to just go sit in the hospital for an hour and a half. So I walked around Norwood. I walked for an hour just around, and I stopped somebody on the street, and I said, is there some place around here where I could just buy a cup of coffee? And she said, what? And I said, is there a coffee shop in this town? And she said, a coffee shop? And I said, I want to have a cup of coffee. And she said, well, there's a drugstore down the street. So I went into the drugstore, and I had a cup of coffee. And then I went back to the hospital, and I walked in, and it's sort of medium-sized little hospital. And I've always worked in hospitals, so I sort of figured that next to the gift shop would be the information booth, and it was. They always do it that way. And I said, I want the personnel office. And he said, oh, well, you just sort of go down that hall, and you turn left, and it's down at the end of the hall. So I went down, and I turned left and started walking, and I didn't see the personnel office anywhere. And all of a sudden, this man was behind me, and big smile on his face. He had a big mustache and a lot of hair, sort of nice looking, but a little paunchy. And he said, can I help you? Are you looking for the personnel office? And smiled at me like this, and I said, well, as a matter of fact, yes, I am looking for the personnel office. And he said, well, come right with me. I'll show you where it is. So he took me to the personnel office and said, here it is. And I went in, and there were about four of the girls waiting to interview for this job. And I said, it was 20 of 10. I said, I'm on my appointment's at 10. And the personnel director said, well, have you filled out a form? And I said, no. And he said, well, fill out the application. So I sat down and I filled out the application along with these other girls. Then he looked at all of us and he said, well, you're all here to interview for the same job, aren't you? And we nodded like little sheep. And he said, well, I'll take you all over together then. So he stood us all up and we walked out. Well, one girl had an interview at 9, one had an interview at 9:30, I had an interview at 10, and this other girl had an interview at 10:30. So we went over, the public relations office was in another little building behind the hospital, and it took us quite a while to get there. We had to go out by the dumpsters, around a couple of trucks, through some construction, into this little building. And then it was a house that they had converted into office, so we went in through the kitchen and went through the dining room and into the front parlor, and that was the public relations director's secretary was there, and she said, oh, you're all here to interview for the same job. We said, not at all, of course. She said, I'll take the first one. And so the first girl went off, and the rest of us sat down, and we waited. And we waited. And about an hour and a half later, the first girl came out.
Hour and a half?
And the secretary looked over at us and she said, well, that's normal. He takes his time. Went in, you know. I was sitting there with this one other girl who was babbling on to me about how she had all this training in television and she couldn't get a job. She had all this training in television. What did I do? And I thought, well, not very much. I said, oh, well, she said, what have you been doing this year? And I said, I've been in Europe.
Tell the truth, Dennis.
you can stop laughing now.
I think my Rick telling the truth. He's having some trouble.
It was a technical thing. Is that little thing?
Next girl was in, and in the meantime, the secretary went out and got us coffee and brought it back because we'd been there all morning. It was now about noon, and I was starting to get a little worried because I had another appointment that afternoon. I had another interview at 2:00, and so I looked at the secretary and I said, "Do you think I'll be out of here by 2:00? I have to be back in Boston by 2:00." And she said, "Well, I don't know. He takes an hour and a half for each interview." And I said, "Well, maybe what I better do is call." Call my other interview and tell them that I'll be late. And so I did. I called and I said that I was being held up in one interview and I wouldn't be able to make it. And what should I do? Could I come and see them tomorrow? And she said, well, the other interview said, well, why don't you call us right before? No, she told me to come an hour later. So she told me to come at 3:00 instead of 2:00. So then it became my turn to go in. The other girl left and it was my turn. It was now about 1 o'clock in the afternoon and my appointment had been at 10. I went in. I walked in the door.
No lunch?
No lunch, no. I had a cup of coffee, but that's all. It's a sort of, you know, scare technique. And by this time, two other girls had come while we were waiting. The little television girl and I were waiting. And two other girls had come in. And one of them was going on and on about how she did all the public relations for a hotel chain. And what did I do? I mean, they're all so damn competitive about it. Who wanted to work in Norwood anyway? I mean, oh, God. So
they needed a job.
Yeah. And so I walked into the office, and here was none other than my friend of the morning who had shown me where the personnel office was.
Oh, no.
Oh, yes, it was the same man. He had this mustache and hair combed back and a little paunchy.
Big?
Oh, sort of medium size, but a little soft, you know. He looked like he hadn't walked anywhere in a long time. You know, just sort of a little soft right here. And he shook my hand, you know, glad to see you, Deborah. He looks, you know, at my resume first, and then said, Deborah, come in, sit down. So I walked in, and I sat down at the desk. He pushes back his chair, goes and sits down, and he puts his feet up like this on the table. Both of them up like this on his desk. These beautiful boots he has on, you know, and he just puts them right up on the edge of the desk. You know, look. Look at my boots.
Where are you sitting?
On the other side of the desk. He's got his boots up there, resting them back, and then he leans back a little bit in the chair and says, now, I just want to look over your resume for just a minute. And so he takes it and he reads through it. Well, what he saw in my resume was that I had done public relations for a hospital for 2 years. And so he doesn't want to let me know that he likes this, you know, that he likes the idea that he's seen that I've done hospital PR. He puts it down and he turns over and looks at me and he says, now, what I want to know is, why somebody who worked in public relations for a hospital would want to come back into it? Why would you want to come back into a field like this? And I said, well, I said, it's the only thing I've ever done, you know, and I can do it. I can, you know, I can write a magazine for you. And he said, well, isn't there a little bit more? And I said, well, what do you mean? And he said, doesn't it just do something to you to work in a hospital? And I said, what? He said, doesn't it just give you a really good feeling to work for a hospital? And I said, well, not particularly. David.
You mean this is the gospel?
This is the gospel. Then he looks down and he says, well, I see you've been in France this year. And I said, yes, that's right. I've just come back from France. And he said, well, how about that? Parlez-vous français, Bridget Bardot, filet mignon? And I said, what? He said, that's all the French I know. Well, I was inside. I almost got up and walked out then. But then he said, now, wouldn't you like, he said, you know, Deborah, I'm going to be straight with you. I like what I see here. And he hit my resume. You know, what he liked was that I worked in a hospital before. And I said, well, thank you very much, Mr. Fleischman. And he said, would you like to know about salary? And I said, well, yeah, I would. How much can you pay? So he told me, and I almost got up and walked out. Thinking, well, this man's a little interesting. I'll stick it out. I'll just stay to the end of the interview. And so he said, now, I do have one thing that I want you to do. I have these letters. He pulled out this stack of letters. And he said, now, my secretary typed these. Now, I don't want to say anything against my secretary, but I want you to look at these letters and tell me what you think of them. And I thought, uh-oh, this is really a trap. He wants to see if I can spell, and I'm sunk. I said, okay, I'll look at them, and so I did, and the only thing I could see that was wrong with them was that the margin for the dear sir was over too far. You know, it wasn't, the margins weren't flush on the left, and so
I thought, well, this can't be what's bugging him. It's got to be spelling or something. So I read all these letters through about three times, and I couldn't find any spelling errors. So I said, well, I'm not quite sure what you're getting at, Mr. Fleischman. He said, well, what's wrong with those letters? It's so obvious what's wrong with them. And I said, well, the only thing I can see is that the margin isn't straight. He said, that's it, the margin's not straight. Now, some people, this bothers some people. I'm a stickler. I'm a perfectionist. Can you work with that? And I thought, oh, well, I can work with a perfectionist, but I can't work with you. So at this point, he stands up and he says, well, he said, what do you think about this? And I said, well, you know, Mr. Fleischman, I think I'd like to think it over. He said, well, you call me in the morning, and if you think that you would like to have this job, you can come back and you have to talk to the man in personnel. And I said, I muttered something about, well, did he think he could get me any more money? And he said, well, no, he didn't think he could. And so I said, well, I would think it over overnight, and I'd call him in the morning. And so I stood up to say goodbye, and he opens the door, comes around the desk, and he grabs my hand and kisses it. And I'm standing like this, and he's kissing my hand. He's holding it with both hands. And I said, oh, Mr. Fleischman, what are you doing? And he said, well, isn't that what they do in France? I said, oh, my God, no. So I went out, and the little television girl was going in as I was coming out. And I just said, good luck.
Don't they give you a hard time if you're married?
Oh, yes. That was, he looked across at me at one point during the interview, and he said, are you married or, he said, are you engaged or seeing someone? I thought, seeing someone? I'm seeing you. And that's pretty general. If you're lucky, they won't ask you if you're pregnant or not. But I said, no, I wasn't engaged. I didn't mention the seeing anybody. I figured that took care of itself.
Well, you know, I kind of have a feeling for Mr. Fleischman. He was just trying to act up to the part.
So hard. Oh, he really was.
And he probably had never been over there himself.
No.
And you got the job.
Poor Ivan. He just thought it really did him. He was so awful. I mean, it was awful. It was ludicrous, but it was awful. He said, "You know, it does something to me. I sit out here and I think about all these people and they're dying." And hospital. Yes. It was just awful. I thought, that's why you're in hospital public relations. Heaven help me, I picked the wrong people.
Oh, dear.
Faye, is it raining out?
Not hard.
Rick's done well, hasn't he?
At least he talked, he didn't go to sleep. He let him talk first.
Maybe that's the secret.
I think he's just listening, it puts him to sleep.
He'd never been off concrete, had he?
Ivan? No. You could tell he never walked on his boots very much.
Jane, what you gonna do out here in the country? You use concrete.
I thought you were gonna put me to work working for the paper in Waldo.
Well, I'm gonna tell you. That's not my idea. I don't know anybody. That came out of the election, you know, the man that ran for Congress against Dave, Mr. Fuquay. Well, he was the Hellstrom's
Skinner.
Yeah, I know him. I used to babysit for his kid.
Who?
Pete Skinner. I know him.
Is that right?
They live behind us in Mainland. They moved a couple of years ago. And they have a beautiful little boy named Greg.
Huh.
I used to babysit for him when I was in high school.
Well, Phyllis, you see, was his campaign manager here, or some such thing as that. She kept saying going for him. And there's a let me see, this little newspaper up there. The Gainesville Sun was against Fuqua. And this little newspaper up there was for him, but they had no circulation. So that little newspaper put a great big ad in the Gainesville Sun for Mr. Fuqua. And that's how it came up. I said, "Why, Phyllis, you don't mean there's any newspaper like that anymore." She says, "It's right up here. It's not at Waldo, but it's up that way somewhere, up in that direction. You don't know where it was." And I thought to myself, wouldn't it be nice? Wouldn't it be nice, you see, to get a little toehold in a place like that? And then Jane said, "Tell us a little about your experience with that newspaper down there. It was a weekly paper, but they still, and you started part-time, but didn't wind up that way."
No, I wound up full-time because they needed me. But the paper is owned by a corporation in Alabama, and they own a whole bunch of little tiny papers, but the little tiny papers can't make it on their own, so they own a batch. And they printed the Sun Herald and Sun Herald offices, and they printed also 9 other papers. They printed the Apopka Sun, and that was a weekly, and one of the Winter Haven or Winter Garden papers. Where is this Winter Haven? That's tomorrow. And they printed the Castleberry paper and the South Seminole paper, and then 2 of these local advertising kind of papers. They're just ads and they're free and they give them away. And they printed the Orange News, and I think the Orange News just covers far north Orange County up in the corner. That's a citrus news kind of paper. And one other one, I can't remember what it was, but every day somebody would be coming in at a certain time to print their paper, so I got to know all those people.
Think of that.
I started working for them because I came home for the summer. This was after my freshman year, and we had a new neighbor across the street. So I went over and I was talking to the new neighbor. I went to the building meeting. And I told him I was in school, and I told him I was majoring in English. And I talked to him for a while, and he said, "Well, what are we going to do this summer?" And I said, "Well, I had thought that far. I just got here yesterday." And he said, "Well, would you like a job working for the paper? I own this newspaper." And he was the editor and publisher of the paper, the Sun Herald, and ran all the other stuff. And I said, "Well, all right." So I went home, and my mother said, "What's a new neighbor like?" And I said, "Well, I don't know, but he just gave me a job." So I worked for the man across the street. And I don't type very well, but I learned how to do a little better. And I was supposed to go. They have a thing. They have 2 regular things in the paper. One is called the personality profile, and that's a bit about somebody in the community who's of interest that they figure somebody ought to know about. And I was given that. And they have a thing called the kitchen corner, which is a female person, although sometimes the personality profile was a woman, usually not. And the kitchen corner was a housewife who was active in the community, and a lot of times they would put some of her favorite recipes or garden hints or whatever she happened to be particularly good at. One person I did put in...
Well, that's a good size community, too, right?
Yeah. One person I did...
50,000?
I don't know. Covered Winter Park and Maitland. And I don't know how much that is. She had the directions for crocheting a shawl. That was instead of a recipe. She just put this shawl pattern. And there would be pictures of both of them, so I had to learn how to do, how to run the camera, how to develop the pictures, and I had to go interview them, and then I had to come back and write these things up.
And take the pictures and develop them.
Right, and that was my standard thing I had to do.
There were two things.
And I had to do as many as I could so that Joni, the woman I worked for, she was the editor, she did most of the writing, didn't have to bother with it, because this was a politicking summer, and they had all these politicians going through, this is right before the primary, and so she could do that. And she covered both of the chambers of commerce and both of the city councils. So that took her mind off the piddly kind of stuff. So that's what I started doing, and I was just supposed to do as many as I could so they would have them in advance, and they would just run them 2 weeks late, and the people, you know, didn't care, as long as they got a copy. But I wound up doing a whole bunch of other stuff. And I spent some time selling ads, and Maitland Day is the 4th of July. And Joni has a very good memory for faces. And I, when I was in high school, worked with the chamber on Maitland Day. And she had taken pictures of me for the Sentinel. She worked for the Sentinel at the time. And she remembered me, and she went home and looked through her file of pictures, and she said, you know, I have pictures of you taken about 3 years ago when you worked for Maitland Day. And I said, yeah. So she knew I knew how it worked. So she sort of saddled me with Maitland Day. Well, Maitland, where I live, they have this big community business. And the 4th of July, I live on a lake, and the 4th of July, they block the lake off, and they have fireworks and a ski show. And they have the Junior Miss Pageant in the Civic Center, and they have two parades. And the year I worked for it, but they always have an adult parade, and they have the bands from the high schools and the junior high. And the year I worked for it, I talked them into letting them have a kids' parade, too. And this is what everybody in the whole community likes better than the adult parade now. And so all the kids would put streamers on their bicycles and their tractors and on their dogs, and they would have all of the kids would have their own parade. And they had a great time, you know, and they would put political stickers on their bicycles, and they would go down the streets with carrying flags, and of course the parents were just so pleased, and they're all taking pictures of their kids in the parade, and everybody goes to see it, and they block off the whole lake. The parade is around the lake. And then we went down, the year I worked on it, I went down and talked the Antique Car Club into having the antique cars in the parade. And then some of the kids got to ride in the antique cars. And the Junior Miss Pageants rode in the antique cars. And we did other things. So I, the chamber, I think they were glad to have me, but I irritated them because the kids' parade wound up being a whole lot neater than their parade, and they didn't like it because they just had the junior high school band and the fire trucks. And we had all these antique cars. And the parents were also pleased to see their kids. But anyway, Joni remembered I had done all this stuff. So she said, well, you know all the people who run Maitland Day, so you do that. So that was the two parades I had to keep an eye out for, the Junior Miss Pageant and the ski show and the parades. And they have a dance. They have a street dance and a barbecue. And then during the day, they have games and booths and things. Maitland's right in the middle of the chain of lakes in Orange County. You know, there are about 1,500 lakes in Orange County. And the next lake up from mine, they put a floating island in the middle of it with a golf hole. And people stand on the side of the lake and see if they can get the golf ball into this hole on this floating island. And whoever does wins a car every year. And they have stuff like that. And all the wives' clubs and the garden clubs and what have you have little booths and what have you, you know. And the who are the ones with the motorcycles?
Shriners.
They give rides on their motorcycles up and down the street. And it's a big mess. And they block off the whole end of the city. So she saddled me with that so she could work on politicking. Because I know everybody that works in it, because the same guy, the guy who heads it every year, is also a neighbor of mine. And I babysat for his kids, which is how I started working for it. That's how I got the job working with Maitland. He figured if I could take care of his two monsters, I could take care of anything. So he saddled me with the whole damn parade. But anyway, I knew them, and I knew who to talk to. So I covered Maitland Day for her, and every week I'd trot out and take pictures, and I would go take pictures. They have a statue of the statue. They have a Statue of Liberty that they float in one of the other lakes on the other side. And they make one every year, a crepe paper and chicken wire Statue of Liberty. So I took pictures of that every week, the progress of the statue. And I did all that. And then when their ad salesman got sick, he hurt himself in a skiing accident, a water skiing accident. He banged his ankle all up and he just couldn't get around. So there I was in the back doing Maitland Day, and they figured, oh, well, Jane's not busy. We'll stick her with that. So I sold ads for a couple weeks. And that was one of my projects. And then we had some problems with these people who would come to print their papers because they didn't always pay their bills. And we had this one man with the Orange News, that was the citrus paper, and he was the all-time shady character. He was just a little tiny dark man, very dark, with his long black hair, and he wore black suits in the middle of the summer and smoked cigars. And he had this wife, I guess she was his wife, she was about 25 feet tall, very, very thin. She had the biggest pile of platinum blonde hair on top of her head that I have ever seen assembled in one place in my entire life. And she stood with her height and her hair a good 2.5 feet taller than this man. And they would come in on Thursdays to drop off the Orange News. And what they do is they bring us the finished pages and we make the plates and print it for them. They'd come pick it up Thursday night. But we had to get the money out of him before we'd take the pages. Because we had learned that if you say, we need your money, he'd say, well, I'll give it to you when I pick the paper up. And then he'd send somebody else to pick the paper up, and they'd say, oh, he didn't give me the money. He's going to bring it by tomorrow. We never would get it. But Thursday was Joni's day off, because that was the day that the paper came out, and she needed a day of rest. But I had to be there, because somebody had to be there to help Mary, who was a secretary, and there would just be the two of us. So if Mary was out to lunch, and the man would time it, so he'd come around 12:15, figuring, well, Mary will be out to lunch, and there'll be just that girl, and she can take these pages. So I was given the crash course and being polite to this man, but getting the money out of him. That was one of my jobs. And that was a real project, because the wife would come in, and she'd be all breezy, and, well, here, we just brought you these pages, and we're going to drop them off and pick them up. And I'd say, well, can I have the money for it? Oh, my husband will bring it tomorrow week. And I'd say, no, we need to have the money now. We have to drop all the money off in the bank tonight, you know, before the bank closes. And so this was a regular project. So finally they just gave up and started bringing the money without even being asked. And they'd come in with a big frown and drop the check on Mary's desk and march on back to the back to the printer room. But that was one of the things I got relegated to. And then we had this man who, when he was sober, laid the pages out. But he wasn't always sober. And he was usually pretty good about getting drunk on days when the Sun Herald didn't come out. Because he ran the press, and he laid the pages out. And the other papers, they just would bring us the pages, and all he'd have to do was print it. And he could print drunk, but he couldn't lay out pages because he couldn't see straight, and then the columns would all kind of come out, you know, flop-sided, and he'd put heads on upside down and misspell everything. So I wound up learning how to make the headlines with this certain machine. I wound up learning how to set type and to lay out pages. Something, this is not my department, I wasn't supposed to have known how to do that, but I wound up learning. Because if Tim came in drunk and Joni was writing up the Maitland City Council news, gotta get the paper ready, so I wound up working on the layout pages. So I finally just gave up and I kept a pair of jeans and a long sleeve shirt in the back room, and I would put those on and get the waxer running and start everything. Because we had an offset press, and when you set the type, you just type it out on a typewriter and it makes holes in the tape, and you feed the tape into another machine and that prints it out in columns for you. And it does all the work, and you wind up with these long columns, and then you have to trim them down and set them in rows, and you have to make the headlines, and that's a whole other machine, and you have to figure out how many letters you can get in for a two-column and how big you need to have it, and then you have to crop the pictures and all this. And it's a pretty elaborate process. And then there's a waxer, which is this machine that, it's really neat. It was my favorite thing. I liked it, and it always kind of smelled waxy back there, and I like the smell of candles. And you put this block of wax in it, and it has a roller in it, and it has little teeth on it, and it goes around, and a film of wax comes up on the teeth. So you just hold whatever it is you need on the teeth, and it prints out fine, fine little lines of hot wax, and that'll stick it to the pages.
Oh.
But then you can just move it around. And it's great. It's an ideal way to make a collage or something. You know, you can move it around very easily. So I learned how to run that.
That's
and lay pages
idea.
Out. The waxer?
Yeah.
It's about this big. One side lifts up, and you just drop a cake of wax in. Looks like a big bar of soap. And it has a roller in it. Or it's just a cylinder with little ridges on it. And it just goes around. And there's sort of a grid on top of it, and you just put your piece of paper or picture or whatever it is you want on one side, and it'll come across on the other. And it just goes over the rollers, and the roller will go on it, and it just leaves fine lines of hot wax. So you start off with a big full-size piece of white paper, newspaper size, and you just arrange these things how you want them.
Oh.
And then the lines on the paper are rolls of tape. And if you look at the paper, there are all kinds of variations on the lines. You know, you have continuous lines and thick lines and, like, little exclamation points and dots and all kinds of stuff. Well, they come on rolls of tape, and you have the lines or dots or whatever they are in the middle, and it's just clear. It's about a quarter of an inch wide. And you have to put that down to set off the columns and then mark off the articles. And so I had to learn how to do all that stuff and keep everything even. I never worked with a T-square or anything. I had to learn to do that. You mount the pages, and what they do is they take in the back room and they set the enlarger up to full size and make a printing of it. They make a plate, and it's a metal plate with everything raised, and they heat the plate and put it on the press, and it comes so that there's a ridge here and a ridge there, and the two ridges tuck under, and they fit into this roller, and then they just print it off that way. The roller comes through, and then they melt the plates down and make new ones every week.
And melt them?
Yeah. And they reuse it every week. And that's how they do it. And they have two rollers, so one prints one side and the other prints the other side, and they have a cutter and folder thing at the other end. Well, I learned how to run the press for days that Tim was too drunk to do it by himself. Because he had a shirt rolled up one day and caught the side of his shirt in it and almost pulled his arm off with the press and the rollers. So they determined that Tim needed a helper, i.e. me. So I did that.
Now you were just going to do that 5 times.
Yep. And I wound up working from about 8 in the morning to about 7 at night, 5 days a week, and on weekends when they needed me. And I covered teas and weddings and political luncheons and parades and fires and all kinds of crap. I had a big, neat, beautiful camera for the whole summer, and I would take pictures of stuff. And this was the summer that they enlarged one of the main roads in Winter Park. And the city government fought about this road for all kinds of time because it wound around the lakes, and it had beautiful, beautiful live oak trees on it. Beautiful trees, and they didn't want to tear out all these trees to enlarge it, but it's a heavily traveled road. So there was another road near it, and they figured, all right, we'll enlarge that one, let people go 2 blocks out of the way. Well, they finally fought it down. They wound up enlarging this one road, tearing out all the trees. So I would take pictures of this road in various stages of repair, and it just killed me to see them do it, because it was the way I used to go to school when I drove to high school, and it's one of my favorite streets. And they took out all these oak trees. And I would wear pants that day, and I would climb up a tree and take pictures of it goes downhill. And one day I climbed one of the trees and took a picture from the top of the tree to all the trees they had torn out down the hill. And they had to build a new bridge, and I climbed down under the bridge and took a picture of the bridge being built. So we had a lot of really interesting pictures that summer. Just because I was the only one with the energy or stupidity or whatever it takes to climb trees and go down in ditches and stuff. To take them, but I did that. And that was something. So I just wound up with I had the Maitland Day picture every week, and then I had the Corinne Drive picture every week.
Okay.
I went over to the fire department and the police station every week, and the first time I went in, I had had my hair braided, and I had on shorts and a t-shirt, and I went in and I said, hi, I'd like to see your files, because this was a day that I worked on the press, and Joni didn't have time to go over, and she said, well, come on over, it's across the street. And I didn't, you know, normally when I worked, I wore a dress and walked around looking not 17 years old. And I walked in to the police station with my hair braided and barefoot and shorts and a t-shirt, and I said, hi, you know, I'd like to see your files. And they just looked at me, you know, I was out of my mind, you know, and you know, she just wants to see our files. And I said, well, I'm from the Sun Herald, and Mrs. Babb sent me over, and I needed to see the files. And they called Joni, and they said, Mrs. Babb, we have this girl here. And they said, would you let her see the files? She'll wear a dress the next time she comes in. Give her the goddamn files. I need the information. So I got the files and marched back over to the Sun Herald and printed up things that were interesting and carted them back over. And finally, you know, by the end of the summer, I would walk in, and they'd say, well, hi, Jane, and they'd just give them to me, you know, and it was all right. And then going to the fire department was more of the same. But I would do that, you know, the last day. And the last day I would be printing and waxing and making stuff. And you know, I just couldn't see Rick in a good dress. Because, Tim, we have these tables that are just up at an angle. And then there's a ridge at the bottom for putting pencils and rulers and things in. And Tim, the print-up man, used to put his cigarettes there. And I'd walk by and burn holes. And everything I had cigarette burns at this one certain place where I hit this stupid rim. And so I just had an extremely scorched pair of jeans I wore in the back room, and that was all I ever wear, you know. But the police department finally did get used to me coming over there, you know, asking for their files. But I did that.
Jane, you just missed your calling. I mean, I don't know how in the world you just cut loose from down there. What'd you do? Tell them?
Yeah, I went back to school, and they tried to get me to work there last summer, but I didn't. Because I didn't go home. I stayed up here.
Well, why didn't you write down there?
Well, the paper changed hands. What it was, Mr. Knowles, the guy who was my neighbor, just all of a sudden one day determined that he was obviously God's gift to the world. And he went over to the car place, one of the car dealers, and bought a new car, charged it to the Sun Herald.
Huh.
Went over to the phone company and had a phone put in it. Now, why he needs a phone, I couldn't tell you. I have no idea, because he never really did anything. He just sort of lurked around a lot. But he had this brand new car with a phone in it. And then he had his office carpeted with a pad that thick and this beautiful bright red shag rug. And he got a new desk. And he just started running up these bills and charging everything to the Sun Herald, knowing that if the Sun Herald couldn't make it in ads, that the home company would cover it. And what he did was he got the Sun Herald about 3 sneezes from being completely bankrupt. So he got fired by the home company, and I don't know what he's doing now. He finally moved away. And they got a new man in it, and the new man is right out of the journalism school of the University of Alabama, and I met him. I went down to have lunch with Joni and Mary. Joni was the woman I worked for, Mary was a secretary. And I always go down and have lunch with him when I'm home. And he's this little, kind of busy, wide-eyed man, and he's just full of being in journalism school. Well, he's driving Joni nuts. She writes the paper, he doesn't write the paper, and he was driving her crazy. He had Mary climbing the walls. And he's one of these people that you just really can't talk to because he's just so full of these just ridiculous, bright ideas that you can't talk to him. What he wanted to do was have Joni look around the community to find an understanding woman who could write a dear so-and-so column for the paper. And Joni said, I'll be goddamned if I'm going to spend my time looking for a woman to write some goddamn column for that paper when we need all the space we can get to cover the city news and the local news. We have plenty of news without somebody writing in a lost love column. And she just wouldn't do it. Well, this was his idea. What we need is something that the women will be interested in. And Joni said that if a woman is so interested in the community that they buy the paper specifically to get the community news, you're not going to be dumb enough to read a lost love column. So she told him that, and they just didn't get along. So Joni left the paper. So he took over the editorship. And he's just a terrible man, and I couldn't work for him. I'd go out of my mind. I'd work for Joni, but I wouldn't work for him. Because he just was full of these ideas.
Well, that's a shame, isn't it?
Yeah.
Because last summer you could have been down there. You up here just doing the same old thing.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
And you had a toehold in that newspaper. Yes. You know, I wish I could live your life for you. I was just getting a nice little newspaper somewhere where I could just be the handyman and do everything like you did down there, you see.
Well, see, that's one good thing about it. That's one reason I don't worry about too much about having a degree in English, because I can do that. So I may be illiterate, but at least I'm still useful. I can do some stuff. I can build pages, if nothing else, and work in the print room.
Yes. You and Robinson Crusoe. Robinson Crusoe got her, damn it. It got me too. Except I wasn't associating with a graduate professor. It just got me like a plain ordinary citizen. Rick, what'd you find out?
I got to talk to Alice Murphy.
Yes.
Who's got a just gorgeous office. 12th floor of Lakeshore Towers, and she can look out and see all of Gainesville. She can see Painsbury.
Yeah.
And she is one of the most pleasant women I have ever talked to.
Yeah.
Beautiful brown eyes, a big mouth, and when she smiles, her whole face lights up.
Yeah.
And of course, her office is an apartment, so they've got a sink, two bathrooms. I came in, would you like a cup of coffee? Coca-Cola. She had a big 16-ounce Coke. I said, I'll take coffee. So we sat down and talked.
I'll be damned. Is that not something? The way he gets around. You never heard me like that.
Explain a little about what we were doing. And she said, well, as I see it, then you study the mode that these people use to express themselves. And I said, well, that's close. And I asked her what she did. And she's in with the College of Medicine. She got out of university in 58 with a BA in English and went on to graduate school. I guess she's got a doctorate. I don't know. She sure did refer to herself as Dr. Alice Murphy. And what her department does is, I don't know. I forgot to ask her. They set up those community health clinics. That's what it is. And then since she had a graduate degree in anthropology, on the side, she talks to people to find out about their old country cures, their old home remedies. But she says, I'm very specific about it. I want information, and I ask questions. She doesn't use a tape recorder. But she can move in the countryside because her husband is a rural southerner. She's been married about 20 years. And she said the first time she went out, it's in Lafayette County, which is between... about 65 miles from here, between here and Tallahassee, about 3,000 people. And so I went out, and she said, you know, there's a hierarchy. I didn't know what it was, but I was fortunate enough to stop at just the right house the first time. And these two men came out, and I said, I'd like to see the wife. And she introduced herself from community health and whatnot. And they said, well, she's gone fishing. And I said, well, I wish I'd known. I would have gone fishing with her. And the conversation went on like that. And she always said the right thing and kept it going. And she said when she left, she thought about it, and she thought, now why in the world did I talk like that? She didn't know she could do it. And then she realized she knew the country way of talking. She knew how to move among them. And she said what she's trying to do now, since she can see this culture, she called it, she's trying to tell these med students that the clinical setup that they come out of isn't the only place in the world. People in the country are a little different. And you got to learn to see through their eyes. And she used that word, seeing, so she got to see that. And
is that right? Well, by God.
I was amazed. Of course, I thought about it later. She does put a lot of terms on things, ethnocentric and whatnot, but that's the anthropology in it. She's pretty easy on it. And she said what happens is in the country you have certain, she called, psychological phenomena. And if you take them out of the rural setting and put them in a clinic, they look like they're mentally ill. And she tells the staff, because the staff is students and they rotate on a rotating basis. She tells them, now you're going to have a high incidence of what you think is mental illness in here. But they've got to realize it's because they're looking at it out of context. So I was very much impressed with what she could see and say, and that she appreciated what was done here.
Mm-hmm.
But she doesn't know anything about taping or anything about grants. And mostly what I figured she could do is maybe give ideas on uses of the method that someone that read a grant would understand. She would mention a term, she called it psycholinguistics, which means talking makes people healthy. And she's out of anthropology, and she said, as she saw it, an anthropologist and a linguist would understand this more than an English professor. And I said, we've had trouble with people trying to want to print it. They always want to take the tape and turn it into printed words. She said, yes, I can understand that, because that was in English. And she said, but people in anthropology accept that oral communication as legitimate.
Oh, did they?
And they don't try to put it into a printed word. And so anthropologists are wide open for it. And that like the people she works with, she sees that in a lot of cases, the spoken word is all there really is for a real solid basis of communication, one of the basic ones.
Yeah.
That because some of them can't read. So as far as I can see, she would like to come out. I didn't make any definite arrangement. I said maybe some evening come out and see what we're doing. She said I would, just for my own interest. She didn't know how much she could help, but I thought she would be one to bat it around with. Yeah. I imagine she could say a little bit about what she's doing in Lafayette County. She didn't say too much today. But she's a pleasure to talk to. Easy to talk to.
Well, Shaw mentioned her the very first thing.
Mm-hmm.
and we hadn't been in there 10 minutes before he got her on the phone, tried to get her on the phone. And she was in off at a meeting in Montreal or somewhere.
Yeah.
She's
accessible too. I ask, you know, would it be a hardship to come out at dinner? She said, no. Most of my kids are grown, are gone. She says, I'm not tied there.
See that?
She's bright. And what I liked about her, she's educated, but, you know.
Well, let me tell you, see? You see, you all work with me until you get tired of it. If you could work with her a little bit, see, it'd freshen the thing up.
Mm-hmm.
I don't want to learn anymore. I've learned all I want to. I don't want to quit. I want to do what I know already, you see. I'm Sue. I just like what, as Miss Daisy says, I just like the way I is. Well, it would be nice.
That would be pretty refreshing to bring in here sometime.
Yeah, or to go with her.
Yeah.
Yeah. See, all of you're all old hands now, you see. Well, we'll get Jane for part time. First thing you know, she'll be the general manager, won't she? You going to knock around a while, or you going to quit? I got to wash dishes.
I got to get up and stretch a little bit.
Damn it, I'm so proud of that brown bread.
Well,
or that June. I thought you'd put some leather in it the other day when I first, I couldn't even cut it. You know,
that's because it was still hot.
Yeah. Well, I always thought bread was the best when it was hot, you see.
Some bread is, and some bread you gotta let it cool.
Well, I didn't know that.
That reminds me, that's like German bread, you know? The heavy bread.
You gotta go back?
Yeah, I was gonna go back to town. I have to go see Ted Lansman tomorrow morning and see if I'm going to graduate school now that I got my GREs. And
you have to be accepted in graduate school now.
Yeah. Competition for where I'm trying to get in is really, really stiff.
Yeah.
They closed their admissions last March. They were supposed to have been open until September, and they closed them in March. Because I filled it up. They had a million billion applications, and they could only take 60 people.
Is that right? They just gone out, Rick's gone out stretching with Sue.
I don't care whether you're doing that. Are you going to say hi? I want you to take those Jeremy from oranges.
Okay.
I've got a little platform.
Okay.
Mm.
I just ripped the whole thing. So much sitting. You could be riding and walking.
Yeah, I can walk around.
Yeah.
Waking up to drive back in.
Did you tear your pants?
I just ripped the whole seat out of them. What's that?
I do that all the time.
Better mend them.
Look at that. And they just get into their right state, don't they?
Is this where they're soft, you know?
How did you get?
I don't know, but I did it.
You did all that? You didn't know how you did it?
No.
Yes.
I wonder how long it's been that way. Well, it's pretty out.
Okay. Next shift.
You left you too many dishes, yeah. I think, Miss Miles. You left you too many.
Too late.
I go get some fresh air.